I. Everyone complete what you are now doing and stand by. There are 45 seconds to go before the 2 minutes hit.
George Orwell is best known for 1984, a novel about a surveillance society where people have been brainwashed by a figure known as Big Brother, who is always watching. In this scene from the 1950s movie adaptation, a journalist is redacting his facts in accordance with orders when he hears this announcement, Big Brother convening the people for a daily exercise where they're called to look at pictures of their enemies and to practice hating them.
For Goldstein, we can feel only one thing. Hate for Goldstein because he would stab us in the back. Because from his hiding place, he helps and directs our Eurasian enemy.
Yikes. It turns out 1984 was not Orwell's first foray into the relationship between mass manipulation and politics. A KU professor found a manifesto written by Orwell that called for the prevention of what he referred to as psychological warfare. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and that professor is with us now. David Smith is a sociology professor at KU and author of a new book on Orwell, George Orwell Illustrated. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina.
So tell me about the manifesto itself. What is in this manifesto and why might it be surprising? What does it tell us that we didn't know?
Well, the first thing to understand is that Orwell wrote the manifesto shortly before he began writing 1984. And 1984, of course, is incredibly famous and hugely influential, but it's often interpreted narrowly. People often think that 1984 was a prediction of a dire and inevitable future. But in reality, Orwell intended it as a warning, and he was not convinced that the warning that he was putting forward would come true in reality. So, in fact, when the book appeared, when 1984 appeared in the year 1949, just 7 months before Orwell died at the young age of 46, he was instantly greeted with a chorus of reviews that said, Orwell has painted the dark future ahead of us. And he was pleased that he was being noticed, but he was perturbed that he was being interpreted as a prophet of doom. He felt that what 1984 portrayed was a very real possibility, but that it was entirely possible also to fight that future off. And so shortly before he had begun writing 1984, in early 1946, right after World War II, he wrote a short document with two very famous co-authors, one of whom was the novelist Arthur Koestler, famous for the novel Darkness at Noon.
Oh my gosh, that novel is, that's the only novel, that's the only thing I've ever read that's fiction that made me physically ill.
Orwell was a great admirer of Koestler's novel, and Koestler was a great admirer of Orwell, and they were close friends. And in fact, they got together over Christmas. Orwell and his young son Richard visited Koestler and his family at their Christmas in Wales in 1945, just months after World War II. And Orwell and Koestler began talking about what they might be able to do to play a constructive role in the post-war period. And they were both fearful that the unity between the Soviet Union and the United States and Britain might be ruptured after World War II. They felt that all of the great powers deserved criticism, but that it was important for peace, for the great powers to remain harmonious. And they began talking over Christmas about whether or not they could play a constructive role. And they decided to try to form an entirely new organization that would call for freedom of information and democratic rights across every border. And it was on the heels of that conversation that Orwell wrote A Call to a New Organization, which in my book I call Orwell's Manifesto. It was written in dialogue with Koestler. And Koestler had
it. Can I jump in and ask a question
about
this? Had Arthur Koestler already written Darkness at Noon? George Orwell had not yet written 1984.
Right. The context here is that Koestler became famous way back in 1940. This is right before Britain got involved in World War II for Darkness at Noon, which was largely a meditation on the purge trials, the so-called show trials, where so many people were persecuted in Russia. And Kessler had a lot of knowledge of that whole history. And so he had met Orwell at about that same time. Orwell at that point was not really famous. He first became internationally famous for writing Animal Farm, which appeared in 1944. So by the time they got together with their families for Christmas, Kessler had been famous for some time and had published other well-received books. And Orwell was just in the first flush of a kind of celebrity for having written Animal Farm.
And so it calls for an international organization, but can you just sort of lay out a little bit more clearly, like, what the document says? Like, an organization for what and for why?
Okay, well, yeah, excellent way to approach it. They felt that a new kind of human rights organization was necessary, one that didn't focus only and narrowly on traditional civil liberties. They wanted every kind of human right, every kind of democratic right to be brought to the fore. And they wanted people to press for these rights across every border in every country. And so they thought
outside. But rights like what? What would not be considered sort of like a traditional civil liberty or human right that would be covered by this, the actions that people would take after reading this manifesto?
Okay, well, they were thinking outside the box in a couple of ways. One very straightforward one is that they were thinking about children. And often when you think of a civil liberties case or you think of a human rights organization, the word children isn't the first word that comes to mind. But the way they saw it, and this was Orwell in particular, the way they saw it is that human rights begin at birth, and that the fundamental plank of the new organization they wanted to form started with this comment. They said, we must press for what they called equality of chance, equality of opportunity for every newborn. And what that meant was that you can't truly have democratic rights in the full sense if children don't have every opportunity from birth. So that was the very first plank in the platform they were putting forward.
What else? What else is in there that's sort of stands out as, yeah, like not just something that's was already in existence by virtue of the UN, for example?
Well, the UN actually was just in the process of being formed at this very moment, and the United Nations Human Rights Commission was actually not yet in existence, so they were ahead of the game there. So in addition to pressing for equal rights for children from birth, and they meant by that economic rights, too. They believe that no child should be left behind. No child should be left behind economically. They extended that to adults. So the second plank in their manifesto was freedom from exploitation. And they said specifically economic exploitation. So they said that whether people are being pushed around, whether they're being exploited by private individuals or by governments, those are the kinds of rights that have to be defended. And then they were very much concerned with a kind of right that's on everyone's lips right now, and that is the right to accurate and freely dispensed information and opinion of every kind. In a funny kind of way, they were almost anticipating a world of social media. What they saw was a world where governments increasingly made it difficult for their citizens to get everyone's opinions and facts from all sides of the spectrum. And so they wanted to press hard for completely open information borders. They wanted to press every government to allow opinions and data from every source across their borders to permit the freest possible discussion and to give citizens of every country the opportunity to weigh the opinions and weigh the facts presented from different sides.
Did they lay out how this would be achieved and what the dangers to it would be without some sort of body like committed to ensuring that access to information?
Well, that was why they were writing not just an essay, which would have been a standard thing for either Orwell or Kessler. Both of them wrote many, many really wonderful essays. But this was actually a call about a 1,500-word call that they wrote for the purpose of sharing it with others who they wanted to join them in forming a new organization. So this was not simply a philosophy. This wasn't simply a bright idea. They wanted to take concrete action. And that's one of the aspects of this manifesto which stands out for me. Orwell had had a history of direct political activity. He fought in the Spanish Civil War on the Democratic side. So he was not somebody who was always closeted away in his study writing. But he hadn't formed an organization before. He hadn't had that kind of experience.
Like a call to direct action.
Well, it was a call initially, a call to a permanent organization that would represent the interests of people who are pushed around or who are denied their rights. They felt that the human rights organizations which had come into existence before World War II were a little bit narrow and a little bit antiquated in the way they approached the world. What Orwell and Kessler felt was that the war had put human rights in a new light, that atrocities on a grander scale had occurred and in so many different ways in so many different places. They felt that fresh thinking had to be brought to bear, and they had a network of friends across in several different countries, including Mexico and France and Italy. And so their intent was to send this call to the people they already knew, to their friends and associates, and convene a meeting that would then form an organization that would permanently press for these kinds of democratic rights.
How did you, a sociology professor at KU, come to find this manifesto written by George Orwell in collaboration with Arthur Kessler?
Well, I should say one word about my own collaboration to begin with. This is an illustrated book, and what that means is that it's text that I wrote.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here and explain. You have published this in a book.
Yes, this is a book called George Orwell Illustrated, and the word illustrated is very seriously intended because this book is a scholarly work on one level, but it's also in some ways almost like a comic book. It is bursting with original art by my artist colleague, Mike Mosher. And so we were writing this creative, lively account of Orwell's life. And I was reading the final volume of his collected works.
And are you listening to music?
Oh, excuse me. not intentionally.
Okay. Well, go on. Just wanted to clarify what's going on there.
Sorry, I didn't. I'm surprised that was audible, but nonetheless. So we were writing. I was writing this illustrated book, and I was reading the final volume of Orwell's collected works, and I discovered correspondence with some very interesting and obscure figures who I found interesting. And one day, I just had a hunch. I thought that his correspondence with one person in particular seemed intriguing, and her name was Ruth Fisher. She had a long and colorful political history. And I thought, I wonder if there are more letters between Orwell and Fisher. Just a simple thought. And I thought, well, how can I find out? So I discovered that her archive was at Harvard. And so I actually retained a Harvard graduate student to go look at one or two of the boxes in her archive that sounded promising from that same time period. So he opened up a box, took out his cell phone, and took some photos. And it turned out that he took pictures of the manifesto, which had been sent to Fisher.
So as you've mentioned, you have collaborated with an artist. You've done a book on this. It's called George Orwell Illustrated. Can you tell me a little bit more about that project and how this manifesto has come to inform it?
Well, discovering the manifesto changed it. The book itself was intended to be a lively account of Orwell's life and thought, and it does consist of an account of Orwell's life from birth till death, with a discussion of a great many of his activities and writings. But I wasn't expecting to find this entirely new document. And I should add, too, that this document was co-authored not only by Kessler and Orwell, but by a third author, and that's the very famous philosopher Bertrand Russell. So my jaw dropped when I saw this document. it was drafted by Orwell, and then with input from Kessler and Russell, it was edited. So my jaw dropped. Not only was it three famous authors, they were three famous authors calling for an entirely new organization with what they regarded as a new approach to civil rights and democratic rights. So I studied the document very carefully and tried to understand what it really meant in the context not only of Orwell's life, but of the moment. And so that led me to months and months and months of further research. And my artist colleague was very tolerant of the delay, and he provided some wonderful illustrations for the substantial section of the book, which now discusses the manifesto and what it meant, the context, the whole point.
What do you find current or maybe even prescient about this manifesto? That's what people are calling it, prescient. It's written by George Orwell, Arthur Kessler, and Bertrand Russell in 1946.
Well, it seems almost as fresh as the headlines. That's one of the very first things that comes to mind. And there are some interesting parallels and some interesting oddities. So, for example, one of the biggest topics of discussion for the last few years has been the kind of disinformation that has been flowing electronically across every border. And that's...
There are a lot of different terms for that. I like disinformation.
the word disinformation certainly applies. And in fact, it was a coinage in Russian in the early 1920s to begin with. In any event, disinformation of all kinds has been flowing. And it's almost the exact opposite of what Orwell and Kessler and Russell wanted. They wanted people who had been starved of facts to get the facts. They wanted people who had been deprived of the opportunity to hear other people's point of view, hear those points of view.
I jump in here? It is interesting that is definitely one compelling way to characterize social media. At the same time, when you think about something like Black Lives Matter that is based on people documenting video footage of what is happening to them in their lives and making that accessible to people, that is one kind of fact deprivation that has been sort of like alleviated by social media in some way. Also thinking just about something like what was called the Arab Spring and how Twitter contributed to that. It's sort of interesting just thinking about what is social media's relationship with access to information.
Yeah, absolutely. And Orwell was not a primitivist who wanted to roll back all these wonderful technologies. One of the interesting features of 1984 is that the novel features televisions. And for a book published in 1949 to have the whole concept of a television, especially a two-way TV featured, was different. Orwell was by no means against TV. He saw the potential for the sharing of information on a wide basis, and I'm sure he would feel extremely positive about many aspects of social media. It's in the phrase of one of his teachers, Aldous Huxley, it is a brave new world, and the opportunity to share information and to be exposed as well to disinformation. Those are the two sides of the coin of social media. And Orwell, I'm sure, would not have wanted to roll back social media.
When they talk about wanting to protect people against disinformation, how did they claim that you would do that?
Well, at the beginning of the show, the phrase psychological warfare was used. And in some ways, the kind of disinformation that we're describing, particularly when it's put forward by states, does amount to a kind of psychological warfare. What Orwell and Kessler in particular wanted, Russell was a little bit less enthused, was something that Orwell and Kessler called psychological disarmament. And what they meant by that was not something vague. They wanted actually for the great powers to be pressed to sign a treaty that would open their borders to every kind of information. So they said that psychological warfare consists of sending targeted propaganda messages in order to narrowly influence the people who are listening to follow the advice of the propagandist. What Orwell and Kessler wanted was psychological disarmament agreed to by governments, which would entitle anyone anywhere to share information so that people in Britain could share their thoughts and ideas with people in Russia. People in Russia would be entirely free to do the same. And so the idea was to take the center of gravity away from governments to let the public everywhere communicate directly.
I mean, you also mentioned children, and especially in the context of the fairly recent news of an incident surrounding separation of families at the border, that strikes me as interesting as well, just where children are positioned within this very early concept of internationally ensured human rights.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That thought has struck me on many days. And of all the contemporary documents that I've read recently, one that really sounds kind of like Orwell to my ears is a document that bears on that. And you mentioned the United Nations. The special rapporteur for the United Nations, whose portfolio is extreme poverty, is an American whose name is Philip Alston. And Alston has written a series of really important documents which he has submitted to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. And he has focused like a laser on some of these very issues, including the issue of children at borders and children in cages.
You know, 1984, as I think we've mentioned, it was written 3 years after this manifesto was written. Do you think that 1984, in some ways, is a translation of this argument into fiction?
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, what happened during 1946 was that the organization that Orwell and Kessler tried to start didn't get off the ground for a number of reasons. But the most important reason was that the Cold War got off the ground. So they wrote the manifesto hoping that they could intercede and play a small role in preventing a Cold War. And when by late 1946 it was clear that the Cold War was going to be in full force soon, they felt that the opportunity had passed. And it was at that exact moment that Orwell left London and went to an island in the Hebrides off Scotland to write 1984. So it was almost a direct transition. When that organization proved to be stillborn, Orwell decided to do what he did best, and that is write about the very same issue, but write about it from the standpoint of highly imaginative fiction.
Yeah, what happens in his mind if you don't do what he's calling for?
Exactly.
How are people responding to your book and to news about this manifesto?
Well, the manifesto, since it's a new discovery, has attracted a fair amount of attention, and that's very gratifying, partly because it leads people back to Orwell in a bigger sense. Orwell, in memory, is very much the author of 1984, and to a somewhat lesser extent, in people's imagination, the author of Animal Farm. And those two books deserve to be front and center. But Orwell was a remarkable figure on a great many levels. And to the extent that people are discovering that there's more to him and are being led back to his own writings, I'm very pleased. Orwell was not only a novelist. About half of his work consists of novels. He was also a tremendous essayist, clear, constructive, interesting from start to finish. And to the extent that people find that Orwell, as well as the Orwell of the novels, I will be very pleased,
yeah.
And I have been pleased to this
David
point.
David Smith. So I'm so sorry we have to go, but David Smith with us from KU, thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
David is a professor of sociology, and he has a new book, George Orwell Illustrated, up next, a Kansas City artist just back from the highly contested border between the U.S. and Mexico. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm joined now by Israel Garcia. He's an artist and gallery owner here in Kansas City who crossed the border into the United States with his parents as a small child. He crossed without documentation and just recently became a citizen as an adult. His art and his curiosity took him to the highly contested border at the border of the U.S. and Mexico so he could see what was happening there with his own eyes. He's back, and we have invited him to share what he saw. Hi, Israel.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me again.
Tell me a little bit more about your motivation for traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border. What did you want to find out and why?
Well, I think for me, I think for the past 6 years owning the gallery here in the Crossroads, I realized that there was a huge disconnect, basically from the audience that I was having that are third, fourth, fifth generation Latinos here in town. And I felt that there was a huge disconnect of the information that was coming to them or that they were connecting to. I really made it an effort to the gallery to present work that really encompassed the Latinx history, also the relationships and community. But I wanted to go deeper, and I think that's where this body of work took me.
And Latinx, just for people who aren't familiar with that terminology, that's like Latino and Latina are specifically masculine or feminine Latinx.
Yeah, and I think Latinx, I think it's just more inclusion-based. I think we want to make sure that we give a hug to everybody and that we're not excluding anyone. So,
what were your emotions going into this? I mean, the news that we're hearing just in headline form is pretty challenging stuff. But then beyond that, this is very personal for you.
It was. I think for me, being able to really connect to the work and really connect to this trip for me was a very emotional trip. It was also for me as an artist, for me as a curator, and it just brought those two disciplines into practice with this trip. And just being highly, to begin with, my work is already highly emotional. But I think in this case, it was not only emotional, but highly personal.
I'm looking on my computer screen at an image of you, like, shot. You see your own eye view as you look down at your feet, and you've got one foot on one side of the U.S.-Mexico border and another foot on the other side. And what that looks like is surprisingly mundane.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the images that I thought was the most, and there was many like this, but I think this is basically one foot in Mexico and one foot in the U.S.
It looks like, to me, a gravel parking lot with, like, you know those like cement posts when you're at the gas station,
right?
And there's one in front of the pump and one behind the pump?
Yeah.
One of those. And that's the border?
That is a U.S. marker. So that is what divides the U.S. and Mexico. And this is in New Mexico specifically. And I think so. And I think this is one of the biggest surprises to me is that there are huge open spaces that are not highly patrolled. And there isn't anybody coming back and forth. Like, there isn't anybody. Even though there are these open spaces, widely open, that they are actually very peaceful. I was there, it was a Saturday evening, and I was seeing families on the Mexico side barbecuing, doing their everyday Saturday thing with their family. And on the U.S. side, you really couldn't see much because there's a big buffer zone between the U.S. border and population, basically. But on the Mexico side, they're actually living right on top of the border fence. So you're able to interact with them, see the neighborhoods. So I thought this was a very interesting thing to see, to be
Were
there.
Were you the only one crossing?
At the time, I was the only one. And for me, I was, you know, I was always looking behind my back, seeing if anybody was going to kick me out, yell at me, or if anything. But I hiked hours in this terrain, which is the New Mexico desert, and there wasn't at any time anybody coming to me, kicking me out, telling me that it was time to go, or even checking to see if I belonged.
So take me through this a little bit more, like, logistically and chronologically.
Yeah.
Where did you sort of, like, I don't know, anchor yourself before you started hiking? And what was your goal? Like, did you have a specific plan in mind?
Well, I think with the beginning of this trip, I've been planning this trip for multiple years. Really began the funding for this trip about middle of last year is really when I began to ask for help outside of myself. I knew a couple of things. One of them was that I would be starting in Brownsville, which was a Gulf end of the U.S. border, and that I would be ending in San Diego, Tijuana. Those were the two things that I had. I realized very early on that because of the complications of the U.S.-Mexico border, that I really couldn't plan anything in between, that it really had to happen very organically, and it really had to be based on who I met along the way and where those relationships took me for the next step.
And you were you entirely on foot?
No, I had to drive, so I knew there was a vehicle just because I had a very strict timeline and limited funds. So I did drive my vehicle to there, and what I would just basically do is park on the U.S. side and then just begin hiking. When I began to hike in the desert and collect the ephemeral objects, I would go back to my vehicle, try to store them, and then go back out.
Explain what the ephemeral objects are. This is something that you were hoping to collect.
Yeah, for me, I think it was really being able to talk about the immigrant and the migration experience. I really wanted to show the evidence of migration, what it is a person has to do to prepare their journey, to really go across very difficult terrain on all four states to, you know, we're talking desert, we're talking water, cold, and there's all these elements that are actually in play, and it really is the same.
So you wanted to find things that people had left behind.
I did. I wanted to find evidence, and I think that that was one of the bigger things, is that we hear the conversation being spoken about, but I think very few people have been there and experienced it.
So what kinds of things did you find?
I found a little bit of everything, anything from booties that would help them if they're in the desert, not leave their footprints to make sure they're not tracked. These same booties would actually vary from state to state. So they were made differently. They were made industrially, some of them. Very homemade. Everything was homemade, industrially meaning that they began to embed, for example, camouflage material. These booties were made from that and carpet on bottom. So there were used blankets. So the material changed very drastically. Water bottle, survival elements, the food cans or food wrappers they would leave behind, and sometimes the clothes that on their back.
Is there an object that you saw that really just took your breath away?
Yeah, I think for me, I think hopefully we've all seen it to some extent. Mexico is very well known as far as some other countries, but I think Mexico is who I connect with their homemade sandals that are made with, like, from tire soles, and they're made out of leather, which is kind of our huarache, is what we refer to it as. And I think it's, when I found it, it was found in Arizona. It was found in the high Arizona desert. And it was just because of the element and the strength of the Arizona summer, it was no longer, you couldn't make it out. It had become a solid ball almost.
So like this, it had melted or
something? Yeah, it had just kind of collapsed onto itself. And it took us a while to take a look at it and to figure out what it was. And I think that's really what hit me, understanding that the terrain and the elements were just so drastic on some of these states that there is, you could actually see why there's so many deaths as well.
You know, was there a difference between, like, initial, how long were you walking along the border?
Well,
traveling along the border.
Right. The whole trip was a month and a half.
So, like, is there a difference between your early observations as you're, because you're moving across this terrain, but, like, you're also moving through time and spending more time thinking and reflecting as you're going. Are there observations it took you longer to come to?
Yeah, I think for me, well, I think the very earlier observation that I was able is my own safety. I realized very early on that I was putting myself in a very dangerous situation. And, you know, one of the comments that I've made before is that I actually felt safer in Mexico than I did in the U.S. border dealing with Border Patrol. And I think for me, that was a huge surprise. I felt that on the U.S. side, I would be protected. I would be to some sort, you know, not necessarily accepted, because there is private property, public lands, private property. So there's a mixture of everything, and not everything is marked. So you never really knew where you stood. But at least that you were, you know, going to be escorted out nicely, you know, you've kind of crossed the
line.
Because
you're in your own country.
Right. You're in your own country. And I think, to me, that was the biggest thing. So very early on, I think when I realized I was, this was in the Rio Grande Valley, is that I needed a little bit more support and a little bit more protection. And it's when I reached out to the press that are in Texas and was able to get my press credentials. That way I had a little bit more, a layer of protection and a little bit more freedom to be able to justify myself for being there.
Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question for Israel Garcia about what he saw when he traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border as an artist and observer. 816-235-2888. Israel, how is this trip informing your art right now? How long have you been back?
I just got back. I got back about the second week of December. I came back with the flu, so I was down for 2 weeks trying to recover, and I think just the how rough the trip was, it took me a little bit more time for me to kind of get back on my feet and just kind of get back to reality, or Kansas City's reality. But yeah, I think for me, I came back a completely different person.
We'll hear more about that from Israel Garcia in just a minute. He's the owner of a gallery in the Crossroads Garcia Square, and he's talking about his recent art trip to the U.S.-Mexico border collecting ephemera. Here on KCUR Central Standard, you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm sitting here with artist Israel Garcia. He's just returned from the U.S.-Mexico border. Welcome back, Israel.
Thank you.
So I am looking at some images of, I'm looking at photographs you took, and one of the photos that interests me a lot is of the, this international bridge. It's a kiosk. Can you describe what you were...
Yeah, and that was actually a new element that was just implemented. This was at the same time that this was in Hidalgo, which the closest U.S. city is McAllen, Texas. On the other side is Reynosa. And yeah, this was previously the way they would process asylum seekers was that they would take them all the way across the border or across the bridge and actually process them in the CBP, which is the Customs and Border Patrol facility. So which is just before, it's basically the checkpoint. But then this kiosk was implemented because this bridge crossed the Rio Grande. They basically, the water, the middle of the river is the U.S.-Mexico border. It was implemented that now they would kind of stop the asylum seekers in the middle of the bridge and try to process them there and basically make a waiting line.
So what, you know, how long were people standing on this bridge?
For hours. And I think that was one of the things that really affected local non-for-profits there that were actually helping asylum seekers. They were really upset of the fact that we are talking about desert, it was very cold nights. They were exposed to the elements and they couldn't leave their spot. They would lose their spot if they went away. So you would have families and children really waiting in the middle of a bridge for hours, if not days.
When you talk about days, so people spending the night on this bridge?
Right.
I just, as a parent, like trying to imagine how you go to sleep with your child on a bridge that is going over water, that seems like you just would not go to sleep.
Yeah, no, I don't think any of these asylum seekers were really able to get any rest while they were waiting or in line. And I think it was one of those things where it was really life or death. You know, you really didn't want to lose your spot, but you really had very little to no options. I think it wasn't until further, at least along in my trip and further along in the months where I began to see them being given some sort of serial number to kind of come back to.
There's a picture that looks very sort of like cheerful and happy. There's it's a in a city. You can see sort of like a painted crosswalk, and there are some two boys. One of them is wearing a Spider-Man costume, like the kind that a kid would just wear for Halloween, or because it's Tuesday, depending. And then, like, this sort of slightly older kid, he's wearing a cross around his neck. They've both got, like, paper bowls in their hands and big cups, and they're smiling. Everything looks happy. They're tense. You might think this is like a street festival or something.
Yeah, and I think this is a picture that, I mean, I think for me as an artist, you know, we were surrounded by media, by press, by photojournalists. And I think one of the things that I wanted to, this is actually in Tijuana, where basically the asylum seekers, basically the mass or the huge population that was expected, ended up. So we happened to actually arrive in Tijuana one day apart.
When you say we, who is we?
Well, we, I'm assuming the population of asylum seekers and myself. I really, this journey, I think I really wanted to take it on alone and by myself. I wanted to be reflective of my own path and where that path has taken me. And I really wanted to kind of experience this on my own. I felt that accompanied or, you know, traveling with somebody else, I think might take away from that.
You might just start like telling stories.
Yeah, I think it would take me away from kind of the inner thought that I really wanted to have happened.
So, sorry, you arrive.
Yeah, so I arrive and I think I wanted to ensure that I was able to give back. So I think I really, everybody seemed to be photojournalist media wanting to document the sad, the dirty, the, you know, what reflected these talking points that were happening at the time. But I wanted to show, and this is a happy and sad pictures because what these kids are wearing are basically what's being donated to them. You know, they've have traveled with the clothes on their back, and this is probably their first change of clothes. They happen to be Halloween costumes, and, you know, they got to pick their own costume there. You know, their bags being given, and they're able to kind of look through and find what they want to wear. But this is one of the few meals in Mexico. The great thing about me seeing what was happening in Mexico is that everyday people and everyday Mexican citizens would come on a daily basis and bring hot food to them because they were living in tents. This was actually one of the sports complex, which is the Benito Juarez sports complex there in Juarez, in Tijuana. And, you know, it was a baseball field. It was dirt floor. Some of them had camping tents. Some of them didn't. Some of them had something to cover themselves. The saddest part about this, it was just before a 4 to 5 day rain hit them. And that was, I think, one of the saddest parts because where they had been for the past week, they had to leave because they were forced out for health issues. But I think is also showing the lack of preparation that both Mexico and the U.S. Were going through.
And just individuals trying to fill those gaps.
Right. Yeah. And I think it and that was the thing. I think because of this rain, because of what was left behind, because of what this population couldn't carry from one location to the other, they were judged for the dirtiness of the place. But I think it really came down to the inefficiency of the move, the inefficiency of preparation, and the fact that these asylum seekers were being denied their right to ask for asylum.
So you went specifically to find things that were being left behind, and you just mentioned that a lot was left behind there. Did you collect anything for your project, an ephemeral object from
Think in Tijuana it was actually the most interesting, and I think for me the best place where I could have spent my time, I think once I saw what was going on with this huge population of people, I actually put my research on hold and I wanted to make sure that I would help and I was able to help directly. So as soon as I arrived, I did a Facebook fundraiser. I was able to raise nearly $4,000 and really be able to buy the small things that the Mexican government and some of the not-for-profits there were missing. As small as toilet paper, cleaning supplies, tarps just to cover themselves. They were all given blankets to cover themselves from the sun. But when the rain hit, those blankets were no longer usable. And that was their tent. They were living under this blanket. So for me, that was the first thing that I spent money on, was plastic tarps.
But I guess I mean, you know, with your project to collect ephemeral objects, did you collect any ephemeral objects?
I did. I mean, I did. I did a very little, not as many. I think the great thing about me is that I was able to turn off that side of myself and just really look at the humanitarian need at the time.
So you put that on pause?
I put it on pause completely. Yeah, I think it wasn't until 2 days before I was coming back to KC from San Diego that I began to collect items.
You know, talking about just that you had gone alone so that you could be with your own thoughts, I'm curious how you did end up reflecting on your own journey across this border as you were tracing in the footsteps of other people making this journey more recently, because you did cross the U.S.-Mexico border as a child yourself.
Correct.
Under perilous circumstances, although different circumstances. You were in a car, if I recall.
Right.
And under different political context as well. But did this sort of take you back in your own mind and think about your own past differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think it did. I think I would always try to ask the question of what the process was. And I think for me, knowing that this was the point of entry for my family and our history, I think it really came back to that we all have that part of our history, you know, whether it happened a decade ago or a century ago, that we all have this immigration story to tell. Even though some of us don't accept it or don't feel that, you know, they're the first to come to the Americas or the U.S. And I think for me, it was really that perspective of being able to accept my own history. You know, I think that for myself, there's a certain point where, I mean, I wouldn't talk much about it because it was something I didn't truly understand myself yet. But I think it was this trip where it really brought that information back. Memories as a 7-year-old were very difficult to remember and realize whether they were reality or made up. But I think knowing, being in Tijuana, realizing that that was the point of entry, for me, it was kind of a full circle, especially since I had just become a citizen the past year.
You know, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to take this call, but I'm going to relay a message, which is that your high school principal is calling, and he is curious about the stories that you might have heard from people. Did you get to ask people about their stories? Did you have that kind of exchange in addition to the exchange of objects?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think this is a great thing. And I think that's the great thing about this trip is that everybody that I met along the way that I'm always upfront about who I am and what I do and why I do it. And I think it's what I do. I think it's truly selfless to be able to put this body of work, to be able to write grants, receive grants, but it's all self-funded for the most part. And to be able to meet different people along the way that bought into what I was doing and why I was doing it, and that helped without them knowing or without me knowing them. You know, there were new people to me. So I think it's really that notion is that at every point there's people willing to help, and that there's humanity out there and even at the border.
Also just the idea of the border being this more concrete thing now, that really fascinates me, this little post that marks the border in some places.
Yeah, there is. And I think it's these markers that were the most interesting part of them. And to realize that there really isn't a need for a continuous fence because these markers exist and they're being respected.
Our time is up. Israel Garcia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Israel is an artist in Kansas City. He runs a gallery in the Crossroads, Garcia Squared, and he just got back from a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border. You can listen to this conversation or the one we had earlier about a little-known manifesto written by George Orwell in the 1940s that was recently discovered by a KU professor. Check it out at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you'll find last Friday's food show, where we looked back on the big restaurant news of 2018 and found out what's on the radar for 2019. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.